When I get angry in my kitchen, I really feel the need to do something very violent in order to release the tension. I think that's quite good for you too. And I find that the best thing to do is to throw a ripe pear against a cupboard door is best, because then you've got vinyl paint and it's easier to wipe it down afterwards. So I go right back and I slowly move up, building up the speed as I go. And then at the moment of hurling, I always shout very loudly, because that releases tension.
This is the fourth and final episode of the Domestic Soundscape podcast series commissioned by Sound and Music for the 2009 Cut and Splice Festival. Living Rooms, this year's Cut and Splice Festival, is all about everyday places, home and the ordinary. We open the podcast with a section from Bobby Baker's kitchen show, which featured in more detail in the last podcast. Bobby Baker's work has historically dealt with the emotional complexities of domestic space, mental health issues, and the significance of everyday actions and materials. In another performance, drawing on a mother's experience, Bobby creates an action painting on a sheet using foodstuffs.
Good. Now, I'm going to do this drawing for you on a double white sheet. And the wonderful thing about drawing on sheets is that when you've done the drawing, you can wash the sheet and then you can use it again either for another drawing or as a sheet. You have to be quite skilled and experienced at getting all the stains out, but I am.
As she builds up her drawing on the sheet, she relates her experiences as a mother via short narratives. Each story is accompanied by a related substance like stout or fish pie or stewed blackberries being thrown onto the sheet in a process that builds up a sort of mock action painting through gestures and mark making.
It was just wonderful, because she stewed some blackcurrants from the garden.
These are only tins.
Sorry, I'm too busy. And she put them in the bowl like that. Quite nice. Then she said, I've discovered this wonderful Greek yogurt. And she didn't realise it was sheep's yogurt. I noticed that. And what she did was spoon some in. Like that. And the most amazing thing happens. God, I'll never forget it. You see, the juice combines with the yogurt and you get this fabulous texture and colour. It is just kind of magical, really. You get it from our spray as well, but not nearly as good as Greek yogurt. Sorry, I can't go right the way round. But you could try it at home. It's really great. Anyway, how shall I do this? I think we need that. I love that. Now, I'm never quite sure why, but I get this irresistible urge at this stage of the drawing to walk on these and pop them. It's incredibly satisfying. It's almost as good as walking on meringues. Actually, you'll see, it's my natural sort of eye, that it's increased the amount of this fabulous red, or pink, whatever you call it. Pop, pop, pop. Sorry. There, that's it. That's it. Now, I know from experience, from bitter experience, that I must take my shoes off at this stage, because I could fall over. Actually, if I do fall over, could you pretend I haven't? I will.
As the performance develops, Bobby Baker reveals layer by layer the long and human story of her experiences as a mother. With each stage of mark making, her overalls become increasingly besmirched and dishevelled, and she gets progressively caked in substances that remind us of bodily fluids and embarrassing human realities.
Well, I'd had this secret worry all the time that I was pregnant that I could never admit to anyone. It was a terror that when I had the baby, I wouldn't be able to love it. It really was scary because I found other people's babies when I was pregnant absolutely disgusting. I couldn't bear to touch them even. So you can imagine the huge relief when she was born and I loved her, I adored her. So that was great. But I was overcome with this great worry as soon as she was born, which I had read about, but I couldn't believe it was happening to me. And that was whether I could feed her, you see. And I was quite lucky, actually, because I was. And I found it immensely satisfying. And what happened was I produced too much milk, actually. And I used to send it, on the health visitor's suggestion, I used to send it to the special care baby unit at the local hospital. And I felt, you know, I was doing something for society. It was great. And I used to freeze it in these little bottles. Don't worry, this is only milk with water, ordinary milk. But just to give you the idea. And I'm going to take these tops off now. Let me just... There we are. There's that. And I'm going to put this in, carrying on with the subtle approach, in these sort of little sort of possets and dribbles, which are very reminiscent of the whole experience.
One of the driving impulses behind drawing on a mother's experience was Bobby Baker's sense of outrage at how shockingly undervalued the job of parenting is in our society. And she put drawing on a mother's experience together as a performance to communicate powerfully and materially about domesticity, motherhood, and the role of the artist.
I'm thrilled to be here in Jackson's Lane Theatre tonight to do a drawing for you about my experiences as a mother. Now, I am a very experienced mother. I have more than 20 years experience under my belt. And I have done this drawing now more than 250 times all around the world. So I'm pretty experienced at that too. Good. Well, I'm going to start because I've learned from experience as a mother to always think ahead whenever possible to avoid unnecessary work.
Bobby Baker writes about how in developing Drawing on a Mother's Experience as a performance, she felt she had found a subtly subversive political voice for communicating her anger in a bearable way.
I find it terribly difficult to talk about what happened next because I feel quite ashamed. You see, there we were, the sort of perfect family with a girl, a boy, a house, my husband had work. And so it was kind of extraordinary. What happened was I got postnatal depression next. I just couldn't believe it, you know, really, because I remember the midwife, who was a friend of mine, had set up this group in the local health centre for postnatal depression. I remember thinking, oh, that's really nice for them. And there I was in it a few months later. However, I discovered, and it worked, that it made me better very, very quickly. I discovered, and nobody has ever queried this, no one professional has ever contradicted this, that depression has an enormous amount to do with anger. And I was extraordinarily angry by this stage. I think that's why I love this part of the drawing almost the most. I've got two tins of Lyle's Black Treacle, and I'm going to pop this in. Now, just watch this. Woo! I think you'll agree that it's pretty powerful. I just love this. I could go on doing it for hours. Because look how the line gets all thin and you get these amazing sort of marks and squiggles and little wiggles. And you must have a look later. I'll try and point it out to you, but what happens is the treacle feathers into the Guinness and tea, and it's breathtaking. Absolutely breathtaking. When I was at St. Martin's, we had a tutor who just when you'd finished a painting would come up and say, why don't you put a bit of black in it? which is extraordinarily irritating. However, I think I now see what he meant. It's great.
Much of the anger in Bobby Baker's show is directed towards the disregard with which domestic chores and the tasks associated with motherhood are treated. Another performance artist who has dealt with the idea of undervalued domestic labour is Miel Lederman-Ukeles, whose work from the 1970s includes maintenance work. In maintenance work, Miel Lederman-Ukeles does the chores and tasks associated with being a mother and housewife in the gallery space, thereby directing the specific looking we reserve for art experience and high culture towards the necessary labour and daily realities of life. Here is a section of the manifesto behind maintenance work. I am an artist. I am a woman. I am a wife. I am a mother. I do a hell of a lot of washing, cleaning, cooking, renewing, supportive, preserving, etc. Also, up to now separately, I do art. Now I will simply do these maintenance everyday things and flush them up to consciousness, exhibit them as art. I will live in the museum as I customarily do at home with my husband and my baby for the duration of the exhibition and do all these things as public art activities. I will sweep and wax the floors, dust everything, wash the walls, cook, invite people to eat, make agglomerations and dispositions of all functional refuse. The exhibition area might look empty of art, but it will be maintained in full public view. My working will be the work. Both maintenance work and drawing on a mother's experience question the work that we value in society and the subjects that we consider worthy of our attention. Feminist practices that problematised domestic space and opened it up as a public, political, cultural domain changed the way the house and the tasks associated with maintaining it are perceived. The home and many of the things that happen inside it are geared towards the sustenance of life. The home is where we sleep and eat, where we take shelter from the elements, where our families are conceived and raised. Sometimes it's where our children are born. It's where we stay when we are sick or recovering from sickness. The care, maintenance, and needs of our bodies are keenly reflected in ideas of home, and it is impossible to ignore the body when you think about domestic space. Yoko Ono directs our attention to the mortality and mess of the human body in two recordings. Cough piece and toilet piece are reminders of our animal bodies and their functions. And as with Bobby Baker's work, there is an innocence and playfulness in the way Yoko stylizes and frames these aspects of human existence as discrete recordings. Toilet Piece was one of the tracks on Fly, an album Yoko Ono released in 1971. The release also included a book of event scores called Grapefruit. Event scores involve simple ideas, actions and objects being taken from everyday life and recontextualised as performance. The idea for event scores grew largely out of the work of students attending John Cage's experimental music classes in New York. Parallel to this, and influenced partly by the idea of event scores, a number of artists grouping themselves together under the name Fluxus began exploring the related idea of happenings in and around New York. The Fluxus Manifesto, written by George Makiunas in 1963, urged artists to promote living art, anti-art, promote non-art reality, to be grasped by all people, not only critics and professionals. To my mind, this manifesto reflects many of the concerns expressed in an explicitly feminist context by Miel Lederman-Ukeles a few years later. Her manifesto reads like an event score, investing everyday actions with cultural significance. One of the legacies of this rich experimental era in art history is that we have inherited a radically expanded notion of what can be picked up in the course of our daily lives and appropriated for art making. The event score breaks down the distinctions between traditionally composed scores and other forms of instruction. One composer today who is working in very exciting ways with this legacy is Jennifer Walsh, whose recent show, Groupat, experimented with several new forms of graphic score. I interviewed her to understand more closely her decision to adopt the cooking recipe format for certain works.
Well, for me, it was the idea of trying to think of sound as having a specific weight and texture and temperature, you know, trying to get beyond this idea of like it having a pitch. Do you know what I mean? And really make it a three-dimensional object. I sort of think about sounds quite synesthetically a lot of the time. You know, that's sort of how I perceive them. And so I was thinking, well, you know, if you're going to make a sound, we might make a sound. We might say somebody made a sound that sounded like it was grinding. But how is it grinding? What's being ground? What's being ground against? And the recipe format seemed like a very, I like that very much because it gave a very clear structure to everything. And so I really like all of the recipes, they play off really specific structures of things, you know, that sort of I would go through and I'd look at, you know, the structure for how to make a hollandaise sauce. Like, so hollandaise sauce is very, very difficult to make if you make it properly, you know, and it has all these steps in it. Well, I was thinking, okay, well, you know, how do you get a performer to make a sound that really sounds like tiny particles? And so I was thinking, okay, well, if you write within the text of the recipe, you know, that their body is a mountain and inside their mountain, there's these tiny little creatures scurrying about that are chipping away and they're dumping all these tiny chips. And then they create these internal blasts, which then emanate, you know, that then these grinding sounds emanate, you know. And so for me, the structure of the recipe was a way to give the piece a structure that had this outside structure that the piece could hang on, you know. And then that inspired certain sort of flights of fancy or certain sort of like imaginative ideas about how the sound would work. And then a lot of it also was to do with language, really specifically to do with dealing with language. When I was a kid, I remember my granny showing me Mrs. Beaton's, you know, cookbook, and it had a recipe for hare, and it said, number one, catch a hare. You know, my dad and I thought this was so fantastic that the first step in the recipe for cooked hare was that you had to go and catch the hare. It's funny now, you know, with this sort of molecular gastronomy and these people, Heston Blumenthal and the guy who runs, I think it's El Bulli in Spain, that restaurant, you know, and I've been to WD50, I think it's called, here in New York, which is a molecular gastronomy restaurant. And it's totally bizarre to eat there because, you know, their approach to food is the same as my approach to sound, which is to try and do it in a completely different way to like let you taste or hear things in a completely different way than you normally would. And as a performer, you know, to like put the performer into a different headspace. So that's what the language plays off, is to sort of really try, you know, because a lot of the text scores from the 1960s, they just say things like, you know, listen, play a long sound, you know, or listen till you feel there needs to be a soft sound or something like this. And so the language is, I wanted to evolve that, you know, and sort of push it forward. If you look, like I went for dinner last year at WD50, I think it's WD50 is the name of it, which is a molecular gastronomy restaurant in New York, you know. And so they had hollandaise sauce cubes, if we go back to the analogy with hollandaise or the connection with hollandaise sauce. And I have no idea how they made them. And we asked the waiter, and the waiter said that it took them 3 months to figure out how to do it because it was this perfect cube that was covered in the tiniest crumbs of English muffin. And when you bit into it, you had this mouthful of like the creamiest, most gorgeous hollandaise sauce. Like, how the hell do they do that? And we were thinking, you know, do they do it that they make the hollandaise sauce and freeze it, you know, and then chop it up into cubes and then roll it in the breadcrumbs and then just deep fry it, you know. And the waiter said, no, it was a much more involved process, which involved specific stuff being put into the mix to literally make the molecules move apart, to literally make the fat molecules not bond with the other different molecules in a specific way. Because he said, if we had just done that, if we just chopped it up into cubes and deep fried it, you know, it wouldn't have, that doesn't work. So if, for me, it's that way of working with sound, where you're thinking, well, okay, you know, instead of just letting this be like a B flat, telling somebody to play a B flat or play a long note, like how can you sort of manipulate the situation or just sort of try and coax them into a meditative state where they're going to really make a sound that they feel has weight to it or has warmth to it. Probably one of my favorite performances of these pieces ever was I was doing the Paulian Oliveros deep listening workshop in Switzerland in 2004, and I did a very short one there, and the deep listening group performed it, you know, the people who had been there for the week. And this was like 6 days into a week where you'd be doing Tai Chi and meditating, you know, and all sorts of exercises. And they did the most beautiful performance because they were just so tuned in to the idea of sound having weight and texture and, you know, and like having a tactility to it, you know, and a temperature to it, that they really got it. And I just made the short recipe for making cake. I just made this very, very short version because I knew we couldn't go through it all. And I just sort of talked them through it and had them close their eyes, you know, rather than have them read the score. And I said, like, imagine this is happening inside your body, you know. And when I said to them, now you've made this, you've got the gooeyest caramel ever, and oh, it's stretching, and it's, you can see amber shining through it, you know, sunlight pouring down your face, you know, and now make it, take a breath and make a sound and let this pour into your hand, you know. And they just sort of made these really, really gorgeous sounds. And so I like this idea of, it's like everybody, you know, everybody hacks recipes. They're probably the most hackable things in the world, you know. That's what happens domestically, you know, is that we hack these recipes. There's notes in the margin saying, it says use a pound of butter, but only use 3/4 of a pound because it works much better. You know, when you look, these notes that people make where they say, actually, I don't like the way this works, and I change it. And even if two people make the same recipe, it's completely different. So it's like a score anyway, you know, as it is.
The idea of adopting the recipe as the basis for a score derives in part from the event score. The decision is determined in part by practical considerations and in part by the imaginative development that says all experience, all forms, all materials can now be appropriated for art making. And into that process of appropriation comes the idea that the medium is the message and the notion that the form a thing takes is closely linked to its meaning. In Jennifer's recipe scores, sound is explored so that it becomes a material that can be experienced in the whole body and not necessarily just in the mind and the ears. This one is called Marle Salad à la Famille, and it comes from a series entitled Hostess in a Jiffy Brings You Cooking with Stone, 4 5-minute dishes. A performance of the score in my own kitchen is followed by a reading of it. Marl salad à la famille. Ingredients: 2 cups gravel, 1 cup tap fluid, 4 cubes of milk ice. Equipment: towel rolled up, sheet of newspaper, cream plastic cone, clear shadow bowl, little sieve, kettle, funnel. Directions: 1. Snap out towel and prostrate crisply on floor. Distribute gravel evenly on towel, screen with newspaper, and shuffle lightly on top while singing atomizing melody. Brittle, tipping, porous, even grain. Upon conclusion, fall still, noiselessly becoming heavier for 7B. Dismount. Slide back newspaper, then comb gravel into pile in centre of towel. Position clear bowl on top of gravel, gather towel supportively around bowl and flip over, transferring gravel to bowl. Ball and discard towel. Pour tap fluid through sieve into kettle, then add ice disdainfully. Place funnel in spout of kettle, positioning face in funnel. Switch on kettle and raspily whisper the names of 20 members of your extended family into funnel. Then switch kettle off, remove funnel and rest for 3B. Seal mouth with right hand, switch on kettle and forcibly embed the names of at least 10 family pets in your hand. Then switch kettle off and plunge embedded hand into gravel in bowl. Pour contents of kettle into bowl, letting your hand twitch and quiver mixture as you sing blending melody. Stretched, smoothing, naive. Remove hand. Enjoy. The idea Jennifer Walsh talked about there of experiencing sounds in the body reminds me again of Yoko Ono, deriving work from the rhythm of coughing in the 1960s. So I'm interested in this idea of deriving musical structures from everything we find around us. In the 1990s, Eric Belgium decided to adopt the structure of a verbal fight between a couple as the basis for his work Bad Marriage Mantra.
If you could, you know, relax, huh, once in a while. Fuck you! You're such a stupid fucking bitch.
You fucking dumb
prick. Yeah, fuck
prick.
You, you stupid
fuck
dumb
you,
fucking
you
bitch.
Fucking
I,
w- stupid
when I
prick,
speak
fuck
up,
you,
you're
you
gonna listen up
prick.
To me.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. I speak, you listen up, huh?
If you could just... When Eric Belgium and his wife heard a spectacular verbal fight in a room next door to them in a Toronto hotel, Eric observed the similarities between many musical and literary traditions and decided to create a stylized realization of a different fight with the same deep structure.
Man, shut up! You're such a fucking bitch! Fuck you, you stupid fucking bitch! When I speak out, you're gonna listen up to me, okay? I speak, you listen up! I wish I could just relax once in a while, and I wish you would just fucking blow it off sometimes!
I suppose you should think sometimes.
Fuck you.
Fuck you, you
yeah,
fucking
fuck you.
Stupid prick!
You stupid fucking bitch. Man, shut up. You're such
okay.
a bitch.
Yeah.
Now, when I speak up, you're going to listen up to me, okay?
God, shut up. What
oh.
a fucking...
Well, I speak,
stupid.
You listen up. Hmm? I
prick.
Wish you would just fucking...
Fuck you, you fucking stupid prick.
When I speak up, you're going to listen up.
Okay.
Look, fuck you.
Yeah.
Stupid fucking bitch.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, look, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Okie dokie. I speak.
On first listening, Bad Marriage Mantra is shockingly profane. The endless repetition of accusatory phrases and verbal abuse is incredibly disturbing to listen to. But perhaps more disturbing is the familiarity of its circular rhythms, and the fact that the structure of this argument is not totally alien to us, like the prospect of illness that we'd rather forget in Cough Piece, or the embarrassing realities of the body alluded to by Bobby Baker. Bad Marriage Mantra takes a dark aspect of domestic life and gives it back to us in a way that we can hear it outside of the personally dangerous context of an actual argument.
I wish you would just laugh about it. I wish you would just blow it off. I wish you would
laugh
about it.
You're such a fucking stupid bitch.
I wish you would laugh about it. I wish you would just blow it off.
You stupid.
I wish you would just relax once in a while.
I wish you would just blow it off once in a while.
God, shut up!
If you could, you know, relax sometimes.
Rick.
I suppose I could relax sometimes. When I speak up, you are going to listen.
Shut up! What a fucking stupid prick!
Fuck you!
Fuck you, you
fucking
stupid
bitch!
Prick. Fuck you, you
man,
fucking
man! Shut
prick.
Up!
Okay!
You're such a stupid
okay.
fucking
yeah.
bitch! Fuck you.
I wish you would just...
Anger is definitely one of the most difficult elements within domestic life. Whether anger relates to the politics of domestic labour, the behaviour of loved ones, or our complex interpersonal relationships, it is as much a fact of life as catching a cold or being hungry. Bad Marriage Mantra confronts us with the unreasonable logic that attends rage. And although it is a difficult work, there's also something really celebratory about it. In the unapologetic venom of the script and the vocal performances of the actors reading it, it's almost like a eulogy to the most feared and denied emotion that we are capable of feeling.
Fuck you!
Fuck you, you
stupid
fucking
bitch!
Prick. Fuck you, you
man,
fucking stupid
shut up!
Prick. Okay!
You're such a stupid
okay.
fucking
yeah.
bitch!
Kitchen Antics and Appliances, the collaborative project between Anne Rapstoff, Barbara Dean and Hilary Neal that I spoke of last week, also focused at times on some of the more difficult aspects of domestic life. Hilary Neal told me about some of the projects they did together. One project involved sewing instructions from domestic household manuals onto the clothes of people visiting the gallery and exposing the hidden violence in that language.
This is part of a piece that we did when we went on to Arts Depot in North London. And part of the work was that we had these name tapes and people came into the... Again, we had another huge tea table in there, another Alice in Wonderland tea table, and people would come in and be part of the performance. And then these name tapes, we would sew onto them. So once these sayings became attached to the body... They had a whole different connotation. They're ordinary sayings like pick when ripe and eat at room temperature. So that would then get attached to the body. And then whip and blend to maximise impact. You know, soon they had all sorts of physical connotations. Squeeze or dip to taste. You know, that's about a tea bag, but then you put that on, attach it to a human body. Beat hard until smooth. Lots of violence in the kitchen. Pinch to feel quality. More violence.
So those are all like almost like instructions that you would find in cookery books or something.
Yeah, yes, cookery, that sort of thing. And then we turned it into a whole thing called Instructions for Living and Labelling for Life.
Another project created by Kitchen Antics and Appliances juxtaposed syrupy 1950s songs about home with footage from appliance advertisements. I talked to Hilary Neal about this video and how it relates to ideas she explored in an artist book she developed called The Manual of Domestic Incidents.
Put together a whole CD of music that we called Home, which was lots and lots of tracks to do with home. We did have some work that we did completely for ourselves and on our own within the residency. So this work, Anne put this CD together. And we edited them together, so you had and made it black and white. So you had all these kitchen appliances and people coming in and using them. And then on the soundscape of that, we put all this music of home. But I don't know if this will play on here. As we dug up the dark side, it was still clothed in the illusions that you see through advertising and the nostalgia of the old songs about home as well. The whole thing was closed, and at the same time there was all this chopping and mashing and squeezing.
With this video piece, the idea was to get very violent imagery, almost, or not very violent imagery, but you've got all these domestic appliances and this very nostalgic music, and the imagery itself is very nostalgic. But then the actual processes that are featured are much more, like, they're very visceral. You've got meat being minced, you've got things being chopped, all this kind of thing. And you were saying that's a similar strategy that you took with the manual for domestic incidents.
Yeah. Yes. I really wanted to take the very ordinary, like the sort of the pictures of the older hands crocheting and put in sort of traditional sayings. So kitchen hands are out of date. That comes from a hand cream advertisement. But here in the image above, there's some older, quite wrinkly hands crocheting. And, you know, those hands in themselves tell the most amazing life story that you can't imagine. And kitchen hands are out of date. Well, kitchen hands are out of date. You could say they're out of date because it's no longer appreciated to have older, wrinkly hands, or that the whole kitchen is now run by electrical appliances. But it's all of it is feeding layers and layers and layers of illusion about what's appropriate now in society, you know. And then you go on into people having facelifts or being
anti-process, isn't it? It's kind of anti-process. It's like, I don't want to get my hands muddy,
yes,
while I wash the potatoes. I don't want to get old. I don't want to age naturally. I don't want to knead my own bread with my own hands.
A huge amount of processing takes place in the kitchen. The chopping and the mashing that Hilary Neal talks about are actions we perform in order to process food to our liking, to make it delicious so it can sustain us and bring us pleasure. And yet the implements of this task are violent. Knives and meat tenderizers and so on speak both of savagery and of sustenance. That's part of the complexity of domestic space. That's why it's difficult. Home is where we most frequently remember that we are mortal and flawed. And paradoxically, it's also where we attempt to most keenly exercise our control and demonstrate our civility. We have beautiful wallpaper and we create stunning meals in the very same rooms in which our children and partners drive us to distraction. We make love in the same beds in which we fight. But I think these political and intimate complexities are some of the things that make domestic space such a compelling territory to work in. Sounds taken from the domestic soundscape will always come with context, a link to the parts of our lives we consider most personal and most precious. The feminist artists that I have talked about today were concerned with politicising and elevating the status of the everyday, with redeeming the undervalued and discounted areas of experience that we normally ignore or leave undiscussed. And this is not so different from John Cage's idea that sounds, the sounds which surround us all the time, are worthy of our best listening attention. One could argue with both of these ideas that if everyday reality is so amazing, then why bother to make music or sound installations at all? Why not just content ourselves with listening to what is? But I don't think this was ever the point of making a concert from silence or an action painting from the contents of a kitchen cupboard. I think the idea was about questioning definitions and broadening out the scope of what can and can't be considered as a material for making work. In this restless creative struggle, this ceaseless redefinition and recategorization of experience, new meanings get hashed out and new understandings reached. No answer to the question, what is art, is ever going to be as interesting as the question itself, and there are still a million ways in which we can play with the distinctions between artworks, compositions, meaning, and the everyday flotsam of our lives. One CD which massively opened my ears to a new way of working around these slippery borders is The Breadwinner by Jason Lescalit and Graham Lamkin. Subtitled Musical Settings for Common Environments and Domestic Situations, this release represents another way in which we can experience a collapse in the boundaries between what we consider to be music and what we consider to be sound, because you put this CD on and you don't know where the composition on it ends and the environmental sounds in the surrounding situation begin. Like Bobby Baker's tales of breastfeeding or Yoko Ono's coughing piece, the body and its stories come through at once messy and gorgeous. Breadwinner is a release that only makes sense in the context of the last 60 or so years of experimental sound art and composition practices. It's a CD of music made almost entirely from everyday sounds. Grubby life is all over it. Messiness and banality are here. And yet they are deliberately arranged in the uplifting and celebratory structures we traditionally associate with music. To my ears, it's one more affirmative approach that can be taken to working with the domestic soundscape, along with turning an argument into a sound installation, or using a recipe book as the basis for a score. I want to end the Domestic Soundscape podcast series with a bang. This last piece is composed from recordings I made at a firework display last year, and various recordings of edible foodstuffs. Named after one of Bobby Baker's actions in Kitchen Show, it's called Taste Sensation. You've been listening to Felicity Ford and the final episode of the Domestic Soundscape podcast series commissioned by Sound and Music. This podcast was created especially for the Cut and Splice Festival 2009, and full show notes, links and images are available on the Cut and Splice website at www.cutandsplice.com. The Tapespondence project that I mentioned in the first podcast will be available to listen to on the site as soon as it makes its last and final postal trip. Check the Cut and Splice website for details. Thank you for listening.
What?